This is a tragedy. And sometimes the law, the criminal law, is not adequate to respond to a tragedy. And I fully acknowledge that. And I know many that are watching today and those that are listening recognize that as well. But the response is that the grand jury was given all of the evidence, presented all of the information, and ultimately made the determination that Detective Hankinson was the one to be indicted.
Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron announcing a grand jury has indicted an ex-police officer involved in Breonna Taylor's death. Brett Hankinson is charged with three counts of wanton endangerment for firing his gun into Breonna Taylor's apartment building. Two other former officers who fired shots that night were not charged. As Cameron acknowledged, the indictment falls far short of the murder charges for all three officers that Taylor's family and activists wanted. Police killed the 26-year-old 6 months ago in a botched drug raid. Her name has become a national rallying cry over racial injustice. Celebrities, including Oprah, LeBron James, and Michelle Obama, have all kept her name in the public eye. In anticipation of more protests tonight, Louisville's mayor declared a state of emergency and ordered a curfew. Here to talk about the charges is Marissa Ayati, who's covering the story for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with the grand jury charges. What is Brett Hankinson accused of doing?
So he is charged with three counts of wanton endangerment, and that is related to the shots that he fired that went into a neighboring apartment. And in that apartment, there was a man, a pregnant woman, and a child. And Daniel Cameron today said that there's no evidence that any of Hankinson's shots struck Taylor directly.
None of those bullets, none of the 10 struck her, were responsible for her death?
Right. So what Attorney General Cameron said today was that of the three officers who fired that night, two of them had shots that struck Taylor, that is Officer Miles Cosgrove and Jonathan Mattingly, and that the shot that was fatal to Taylor was discharged by Officer Cosgrove, that six shots struck her altogether, but that none of Hankinson's shots actually struck Taylor.
So why weren't the other two officers charged?
So Attorney General Cameron said that those officers were justified in shooting because Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, had fired first. So when the officers arrived at the apartment, they say that they knocked and announced their presence. Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth, disputes that. He says he believed that the officers were intruders, and that is why he fired one shot when the officers broke down the door of his apartment. That shot apparently hit Officer Mattingly in the leg, and the three officers there returned fire. So Attorney General Cameron's judgment was that because Kenneth Walker had fired a first shot, that the other two officers whose shot struck Taylor were justified in returning fire in self-defense.
Okay, so that was an issue of self-defense. But what about for Kenneth Walker? Did the grand jury say anything about he firing in self-defense, thinking that there was an intruder?
Yeah, so the grand jury was not looking at charges related to Kenneth Walker specifically. Mr. Walker had been charged involving that shot and endangering the life of a police officer previously, and those charges have been dropped. It sounds like it's a little bit complicated in Kentucky because somebody does have the right to protect their home under Kentucky law. At the same time, the officers have the right to carry out a search warrant. So for now, it seems like Mr. Walker is not going to be held criminally responsible, but that Attorney General Cameron is using that shot as justification for the officers firing back.
What about the issue of how they entered and started firing into her apartment in the first place, this issue of the no-knock warrant? The police have said that they announced themselves, but there aren't many eyewitnesses who confirm that.
Yeah, so The warrant was a no-knock warrant, which means that police are able to enter without identifying themselves, but they do maintain that they did in fact knock and say that they were police and wait for a response. Attorney General Cameron said that they had one witness who was a civilian who said that he or she did hear the officers announce themselves. A reporter at the press conference did raise a question about that because several reporters from various outlets have been talking to neighbors over the past few months, and it sounds like had found only one witness who said that they heard any knocking or announcing, that the others had said they heard nothing. But Attorney General Cameron essentially said, we had this one witness and the grand jury was the one that made the decision ultimately to charge or not charge these officers. And for them, that one witness was enough.
Hmm. So what is the reaction on the part of the family and many, many activists who wanted nothing short of murder charges for all three officers?
So far, it sounds like there is a lot of frustration or anger around the charges against Officer Hankison and the lack of charges against the others. Ben Crump, who is one of the attorneys for Breonna Taylor's family, put out a statement calling the decision outrageous and offensive. He pointed out that none of the charges against Hankison are related to Taylor's death, that they're related to the bullets going into neighboring apartments, and suggested that that he should have been also held responsible for what happened to Taylor. The head of the NAACP also put out a statement calling the decision a national disgrace. And so far, what we are hearing from protesters on the ground in Louisville is that they are also angry. They do not feel like justice has been done here, and that they're going to continue pushing for the other two officers who have not been fired to be terminated. And in terms of the family itself, Attorney General Cameron said that he had a hard discussion with the family, but he did not provide any details beyond that about the family's reaction.
All right. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Sure. Thanks for your time.
Marissa Ayati, reporter for The Washington Post. Well, earlier today, Chief Justice John Roberts remembered the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg during a ceremony in the Great Hall of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Among the words that best describe Ruth, tough, brave, a fighter, a winner, but also thoughtful, careful, compassionate, honest. When it came to opera, insightful, passionate. When it came to sports, clueless. Justice Ginsburg had many virtues of her own, but she also unavoidably promoted one particular one, humility, in others.
Tributes will continue to pour in over the next few days. Ginsburg will lie in state in the Capitol on Friday, and then on Saturday, President Trump has promised to name his nominee to succeed her. It is the second time in 4 years there's been a vacancy on the high court during an election year. It has sparked a huge conversation about whether to reshape the Supreme Court, maybe implement term limits or add more justices. We're going to talk about this now with Danielle Allen, professor and political theorist at Harvard. She's been thinking a lot about this. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Madeline. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Do you think the Senate should fill this vacancy now or wait till after the election and after the inauguration?
I think the morally right thing to do is to wait until after the election. Of course, the Republicans have the right to move it forward, but I don't think that is the ethically appropriate thing to do, given how close we are to the election.
So you would be okay with it during the, let's say, a lame duck session after the election, but before a new Congress is sworn in?
Well, I think that depends on the results of the election. That is to say, if the Republicans were to have a victory in the Senate and in the White House, then it would be reasonable for them to move forward quickly after the election. If, on the other hand, power is transitioning from one to the other party, then I think they should withhold movement until the new administration comes in.
So Given the fact that Mitch McConnell, Senate leader Mitch McConnell, has indicated that that is absolutely not going to happen, that he's going to proceed as quickly as possible, what do you think, what do you anticipate happening in the next several weeks?
Well, let me just throw out something that could happen, which would change the dynamics dramatically. It could happen as a matter of principle. Whether it will happen, I think, is a different question. And that is that the Supreme Court could itself decide that as a voluntary matter, the justices chose to adopt term limits for themselves, 18-year term limits, for instance. This idea that the Supreme Court would be better off with term limits is not a new one. It's not coming out of this political moment specifically. It's clear that the longevity of justices has transformed the meaning of life tenure and given us a sort of politically unsustainable situation where the stakes of every judicial appointment are just too great. And that really polarizes and sharpens our politics. So in the ideal, we could take the pressure off of this decision, knowing that whatever appointment would come next would be an 18-year appointment rather than a life appointment, and that the justices would be now on a rotation where every 2 years we'd have a new appointment. Every presidential term, the president would do two appointments. Every president would have that two appointments per term, and we would have a sort of ongoing process of refreshing the court routinely.
But the key word in what you just said is voluntarily. Why would they voluntarily agree now to just serving 18 years?
The country is in a real crisis. We have real breakdowns of governance. Our inability to respond to the pandemic effectively is sort of an example of the way in which our polarization, the sort of deadlocks in Congress, have made action impossible for the good of the country. And you can sort of go through the list. There's sort of really low levels of trust in the federal government, massive polarization of Americans against one another. On any number of indicators, our democracy is definitely at an inflection point, full of vulnerabilities. We need to restore norms for healthy, productive, democratic functioning and governance. And it's always been the case that the norms that have kept our democracy healthy have been achieved by leadership. One of the first and most important examples of that was George Washington's decision not to run for a third term. So there's no constitutional requirement at that time that the presidency be limited to two terms, but Washington wanted to set an example and a model, and he wanted to establish an ethos of the idea that there would be a transition and sharing of power and opportunity and so forth. And the same spirit that animated him could animate our justices. They, above all people, are supposed to set the good of the country and the good of the Constitution above all else. And we do need a reset that would return the judiciary to its role as separate from our partisan politics.
Have any of the current justices talked about this and signaled any willingness to do this or consider it?
I've not seen any signals from them, but the notion that there should be term limits for the Supreme Court is certainly circulating within the federal judiciary generally. So I have heard judges at other levels talk about and endorse this idea. So I am sure the justices have heard the idea, and I'm sure that in ways they are thinking about it. No, I haven't seen any direct signals from them.
Would it be constitutional? Because the Constitution does say that the justices and federal judges should have tenure during what they call it good behavior, capital B, which essentially means for as long as they want to serve, right? Would it be? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's fully constitutional. And all you have to do is remember that justices have chosen to retire, and you can't force them from, keep them from retiring. For example, Justice Souter retired. So for the justices themselves to settle on a voluntary pattern of regular retirement is completely within the bounds of the Constitution.
Would it be constitutional if it was required? In other words, if Congress said you can only serve for 18 years.
That is also constitutional, yes. So federal legislation could achieve this. And the important detail there is that justices at the end of the 18 years would transition to another role on the federal bench. So in other words, they would indeed have life tenure somewhere on the federal bench, but it needn't be in the Supreme Court specifically.
What do you think of the idea of court packing? That has gained currency in recent days. People are talking about that a lot. Should Joe Biden win the presidency, and should there be a Democratic Congress as well, this idea that you could actually increase the size of the court?
I think that's a bad idea. I think that idea accepts the total politicization of the judiciary. And the goal should instead be to reduce the politicization of the judiciary, try to once more reset so that the judiciary is not sucked into the politicization of our of decision making.
Right, because if there's another administration and another Congress, they could change that back or change the number again.
Right. And they're... Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, sort of the court packing view is a view that accepts that a judicial appointment is simply a partisan appointment, and that's its only meaning. Whereas the entire point of the court is that it's supposed to rise above partisan politics. So in order to achieve that, we really have to turn judicial appointments into just a sort of matter of regular practice, where, again, every president gets the same number of appointments. And so there are no partisan stakes in who's making which appointment when.
But hasn't it become an incredibly partisan process? What we're seeing right now can't be seen as anything but partisan.
Absolutely. No, that's exactly right. But so then that we're at a fork in the road where we have two choices. We can accept that it's become fully partisan and double down on that by, for example, advocating court packing, or we can try to turn the tide and turn back to a place where the appointments to the judiciary were not a matter of partisan politics. So the proposal for term limits is trying to reset the norm so that we do not treat the judiciary as a matter of our partisan politics.
Okay, so let's assume that the justices, at least in the short term, don't take your idea up and we are stuck with the system for the foreseeable future. How do you see that as playing out in terms of the public's faith in the judiciary?
Well, I do think that we'll see a further erosion of confidence in the judiciary, that we'll see the results of the politicization. And I think we'll then face the problem as a country of how, given how polarized we are, how partisan we are, how do we achieve corrections to our political institutions that go in the direction of depoliticization? So in other words, we'd be in a position where we're asking our hyper-polarized parties to figure out how to de-partisan things, de-polarize things and reduce the partisan element. That's very hard. So we need things outside of the party system as real game-changing acts of leadership. So the Supreme Court justices in this instance, ordinary voters with ballot propositions to bring in ranked choice voting at local and state levels and for congressional elections would be another way of bringing in a sort of active leadership outside of the party structure to give us a sort of room to start depolarizing our politics.
Danielle Allen is a political theorist and she teaches at Harvard University. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Take good care.
Coming up, how to make indoor air safer from wildfire smoke and from coronavirus, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. What with our smoke-filled air and the scientific evidence that COVID is transmitted mainly via the air, air purifiers and filters are a hot commodity these days. A lot of them are sold out. And for bigger spaces like schools and offices, it could be really expensive to make the air safe. Jeffrey Siegel teaches engineering at the University of Toronto and is an air filtration expert. And he's here now to talk more about this. Hi.
Hello.
So what kind of changes need to happen in places like schools and offices, big places, to make it safer for people to return?
Fundamentally, we need to make sure that every space is well ventilated because we know that dilution with outdoor air is a really important strategy to help mitigate COVID. Where it's not possible to ventilate or where we need more than just what we can do with ventilation, we need to think about filtration. And of course, we should start at the very beginning, which is all the primary measures, things like wearing masks, washing hands, all those things that we need to do to keep us safe, even before we go to some of the building level controls.
Right. So fewer humans equals lower risk in general, fewer humans in one
Absolutely.
Space. Okay, so that's a given that we just need fewer people in places like restaurants, schools, offices, things like that. And then opening windows, a lot of people say that is a great way to recirculate the air. I've read that the air should turn over at least 6 times an hour. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good goal to aim for. That number comes from measles, influenza, tuberculosis, and it's a really good goal. But I have to be very honest, that's going to be very hard to do in many buildings, especially places that get cold or hot when we have to do a lot of conditioning of that air.
Does air conditioning work to clean the air?
Okay. So most air conditioners, in fact, don't have HEPA filters in them. Most air conditioners have a much lower efficiency filter. And there's a couple of things that are really important about filtration. The first one is that filters, a lot of people think the smaller something is, the harder it is to filter. And that's not true. Filters have what I call a U-shaped efficiency curve. And so particles that are about 0.3 microns, which is still very tiny, are very hard to filter. And then it actually gets easier as particles get smaller and larger. And so something like a HEPA filter is rated to be 99.97% efficient. So almost perfectly efficient for those 0.3 micron particles that are very hard to remove. And so it's going to be better for both smaller and larger particles.
Would a particle of COVID fit that bill then?
The COVID by itself, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 0.1 microns, but it very, very rarely exists by itself. It's usually part of a larger droplet or particle. Definitely a HEPA filter will remove it. And in fact, a lot less efficient filter than HEPA can also make a big difference. So for example, in an air conditioning system where, as I mentioned, you wouldn't use a HEPA filter, it's recommended by many that you use something called a MERV 13 or better filter. That's a efficiency standard. A MERV 13 filter is a pretty good filter, nowhere near as good as a HEPA filter, but it still will remove, as long as it's installed and maintained well, still will remove kind of 80 to 90% or more of the particles or droplets that contain COVID.
What should people buy for their homes? Is there an affordable air filtration system that would work to prevent the spread of COVID and also filter out some of these damaging particles from the wildfires?
Yeah. And so the first thing I'll say is I actually don't worry too much about the risk of COVID in people's homes, because the risk comes mostly from being in close proximity to someone with COVID. And, you know, that's your family living in the home with you. And I think it's much more important for us to think about what we're going to do when a family member potentially gets exposed to COVID or tests positive for COVID and how we're going to isolate them safely. But the wildfires are a really different story. The wildfires are a very tough situation to deal with. And the obvious solution, I think, that most people should be considering is portable HEPA filters, which are widely available. And the idea is you put a portable HEPA filter in every room where people spend time, especially where people sleep. And you use those to reduce the risk of some of the pollutants that come from wildfires.
Is that affordable, having a portable HEPA filter in every room?
Of course, it all depends what you consider to be affordable, but you know, they're not certainly not cheap. I think it's really important that we think about some of the inequities that already exist in society. And I hate to propose solutions that cost money, but, you know, a good portable HEPA filter is going to cost anywhere from maybe $150 up to about $500. So there are some kind of do-it-yourself type solutions where you take a box fan and you attach a good efficient furnace filter to it. That's much more affordable. And frankly, many people are having to do that because of availability of portable air cleaners can be tough.
Can these portable HEPA filters be put in classrooms and used effectively that way?
So it depends on how big the classroom is. So a little while ago, you talked about, you know, 6 air changes per hour. That's what we'd like to get going through a filter. So if you have a big volume classroom, you're going to need either a very big HEPA filter or a lot of little HEPA filters. And so how doable is that? I mean, there are noise issues, there are cost issues, there's a whole bunch of things. But I think it's a really good strategy. Even if we can't get to the magic 6 per hour, maybe we can get to, you know, 2 or 3 air changes per hour going through, which certainly will reduce risk.
That sounds pretty costly. I know you're not in the cost business, but to outfit every classroom in America with a portable air filter or to redo the central air system completely, that seems prohibitive. But is that really the only solution to making classrooms and just larger spaces in general safer?
There's no one magic solution. I think we have to start with the mask wearing, the hand washing, the physical distancing. Once we do that, I think we have to address the particularly the classrooms and the spaces in the schools that are poorly ventilated, and we have to fix those. That might be adding to the HVAC system, fixing a non-functioning HVAC system. It'll depend on the circumstance. And then once we do that, then I think we have to look at, okay, can we increase ventilation? That'll depend on where the school is and what types of systems it has. And if we can't, then I think we do have to look towards things like portable filters. And, you know, yes, this is going to be expensive, but the other side of it is the cost of not doing something is also quite expensive. So there's been decades of research at this point that has shown that if we improve the indoor air quality in our schools, we'll get better academic performance, better cognitive function, lower absenteeism, higher salaries for the students when they graduate. So I think if we really take the appropriate big picture perspective here, that the economics change a little bit from just the narrow cost of what it takes to do.
Jeffrey Siegel is an air filtration expert and a professor of civil engineering at the University of Toronto. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how the plastics industry created a bogus recycling campaign to get people to buy more plastic.
They got together and decided, as one top official told me, to advertise their way out of the plastic trash problem.
Why you can't recycle most plastic and how the industry knew that and kept it from us, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The recycling symbol, you know, that triangle of three arrows with a number in the middle, it is reassuring to find it on the bottom of our plastic containers. Sure, we may be buying plastic, but we can clean it and toss it in the blue bin, our conscience reassured. Well, it turns out we're fooling ourselves. Or more accurately, the plastic industry has been fooling us for years. Insiders knew all along that most plastic cannot be recycled. This has now been revealed after an investigation by NPR's Laura Sullivan and PBS's Frontline. Together, they combed through thousands of documents and spoke to the people involved in this big container of deception. And we're going to talk now more about this with Laura Sullivan. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you, and fantastic reporting. Let's start with the plastic itself. This is produced with oil, right, and other chemicals. So it's really an oil industry product. And so therefore, it's very difficult to get recycled.
I mean, that's right. I mean, at its base, you know, plastic is made from oil. And that's really where the heart of this problem lies. Oil is very cheap. So you can take something plastic. Anybody can take something plastic. I think we've all done it in our microwaves at some point. And you can melt it down and you can turn it into something else. But that entire process takes a lot of time. You got to send a garbage truck to your house. You got to pay somebody to sort it all out. There's actually hundreds of different kinds of plastic and you can't melt them together, because it creates this sort of chemical mess. And so you have to pull them all apart, make giant piles, turn it, and then at that point, you might be able to make it into something else once or twice. And then the other problem is that plastic degrades. So it's really just a one or two stop before it gets to the landfill. And all of this ends up resulting in a very sort of expensive process that cannot compete with how cheap oil is. It's just cheaper and easier to make plastic out of oil than it is to make it out of plastic trash. What's remarkable about this is that these problems have existed for decades. These are the same problems that existed in the 1970s, but we never knew about any of this. And I think that's what started our reporting into this, was trying to figure out, like a lot of people, and I'm sure you too, I sort of grew up with these commercials about how great plastic recycling is and how you just put find a blue bin and everything's okay. And I couldn't sort of figure out why I believe that all this plastic could be recycled when in fact it couldn't be or wouldn't be.
So when we toss it into the blue bin, where does it go?
So for the most part, if you look at all of the plastic that's been produced over the past 30 years, less than 10% of it has ever been recycled. And by that, I mean turned into something else. Most of the plastic is buried in landfills. It's burned in incinerators, or it can wind up in countries that don't know what to do with it, or in the ocean. And that's why I think you see a lot of the amount of plastic in the ocean at this point, is because we sent so much of it to China and to Southeast Asia, and those countries were overwhelmed with the amount of quote-unquote recycling that we were sending them. At this point in the United States, especially now that China closed its doors, even if you turn over those symbols, the 3 through 7s might as well have a giant X through them. There are no U.S. markets for 3 through 7. 7, by the way, just means all other plastic. And there may be a market for soda bottles and milk jugs, which would be in the 1 and 2 category. But the rest of the stuff, even the recyclers, you know, all the recyclers that I went out and talked to, they don't want you to turn over and say, oh, what's number 2? I'm going to put it in, because they can't tell a 2 from a 4. It all looks the same. So they're saying at this point there might be markets for soda bottles and milk jugs. But other than that, most of it at this point in the United States is getting landfilled.
Wow. And so what you're referring to is when you look at the bottom and you see those arrows, inside is a number. Mm-hmm. And we've known for a while now that we can't recycle 3 through 7s, those numbers. But 1 through 2, we've thought, oh, if it has a 1 or a 2, that'll get recycled.
We'll put it in.
Are you saying that even that is a dicey proposition?
Even that's a problem for the recycling centers, because a lot of, you know, there's a red Solo cup that's a number 4, and there's a red Solo cup that's a number 2. And someone who's supposed to pick that out and sort that out, they can't do that. They can't, it's not cost effective. That symbol on the bottom of the container, by the way, is part of our investigation. And we went and looked at how this symbol came about. And what we found was this quiet lobbying campaign that, you know, I didn't know anything about. I don't think most people had any idea, that happened in the late 1980s and early 1990s to mandate that 40 states, almost 40 states, put this symbol on the bottom of containers, even though their own documents show that they knew that for most of this plastic, there was no way to economically recycle it. And yet they turned around in the 1990s, starting in the 1990s, and told everybody, you should recycle. And they did this through school recycling contests and expensive sorting machines and nonprofits. And they launched all these big public relations campaigns about, they're going to recycle all the plastic in national parks, and they're going to recycle all the plastic out of New York school lunches. And when we looked at, you know, 12 of these, you know, most high profile projects, we found that all of them shuttered or failed within, you know, 5 years of being launched. And it was at the same time that you saw this incredible burst of commercials saying, go out and recycle plastic, or use plastic, it's so good, it's amazing product. Sort of promoting the benefits of plastic to get out of what at that time was a huge public outcry. Because the problem that the plastic industry and the oil industry has always had, and that the public has always sensed, is that it's a lot of trash. It's just a lot of trash.
So this all started, this idea that, oh, we have to do something to take the pressure off. This started when? In the late 80s, early 90s, when the plastic industry said, okay, what are we going to do? And they came up with this idea of promoting recycling.
Yeah. So in the late 80s and 90s, there was a huge public outcry about the amount of trash that all of this plastic was producing. And people said, you know, we need to start banning this. You know, we can't have all this plastic trash. And the industry was in a panic. And some of the documents we found were, you know, letters to top officials saying, you know, we need to do something about this. One top official said, the image of plastics is deteriorating at an alarming rate. And so it was at that point that they got together and decided, as one top official told me, to advertise their way out of the plastic trash problem.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke with a guy named Larry Thomas, who was president of the Society of the Plastics Industry. And here's a little bit of what he told you.
There was a lot of discussion about how difficult it was to recycle. They knew that the infrastructure wasn't there to really have recycling amount to a whole lot.
Right. So they knew what you just said about how difficult it is to break apart the the plastic container into its various parts and reuse it. And so even though they knew that, they decided to go ahead with this public relations campaign to convince the public that, yes, indeed, you could recycle your yogurt container.
That's right. They were trying to save the image of plastics and make the public feel good about buying plastic.
What about environmentalists? Didn't they know that this was a lie? And why didn't they sound the alarm?
No, actually, I don't think really most people had any understanding for 30 years that it was so difficult to recycle plastic. And I actually think for a lot of environmental groups, there was a hope. You know, there was a real hope. I mean, this is coming after Earth Day. This is metals are being successfully recycled, papers being successfully recycled. Why not plastic too? We can recycle plastic too. And even the recyclers out there, you know, they knew that there weren't really big markets for most of the plastic, but they knew that they could probably find a buyer for soda bottles and milk jugs. One of the first recyclers in the country who was really plugged in with all of his fellow recycling center owners was out in San Diego. And he said that, you know, he lost money on those two items, but the public really wanted to recycle them and he felt like it was the right thing to do. So he went ahead and took those two items anyway. But for the rest of it, what I think happened for the next 20 years was that China took the plastic trash. And where it went from there, it turns out, was a little bit questionable. There was a lot of burning of the excess trash. There was a lot of burying it. And also possibly a lot of reports have come out that there was a lot of dumping that went on and dumping it in the oceans that happened as well. Until finally China 2 years ago said, we don't want the plastic trash either. We can't make this work environmentally or economically either. And it was then that the curtain really was pulled back for environmentalists and the public, sort of saying, this doesn't work at all. Because up until then, even environmentalists were saying, well, as long as it's being put on a boat to China, we're going to count that as recycled, even though there wasn't any real research into, well, how much of this is actually being turned into something new versus how much of this is getting picked apart for soda bottles and milk jugs and then the rest of it being dumped.
So fast forward to now, you spoke with energy companies like Chevron and Shell. And are they doing anything differently today?
They say, I went down and talked to Chevron Phillips at a plant where they just spent $6 billion to make more plastic. Their plan is to triple the amount of plastic production by 2050. If you think about all the plastic that you have in your life right now, triple that. And they're looking at, you know, new countries where they can sell even more plastic. They said that they're not going to have the same problems of the past because the plan is that they're going to recycle 100% of the plastic they make by 2040. 100%. And, you know, when I was talking to the head of sustainability for Chevron Phillips, he seemed very earnest. He seemed like he really believed this. He said he really thinks they can do this. And then I also went and talked to the head of, you know, the largest lobbying group for the oil and plastic industry. And he also said 100%, that's the plan by 2040. But here's the problem. 2040 is a long time from now. And also, the technology that they're counting on is not proven at all and hasn't worked so far. It hasn't worked for the past 30 years. And fundamentally, you can't get around the same problems that existed in the 90s. There's more trash, plastic trash, than there's ever been. Oil is still cheaper than it is. It's easier to make things out of oil than it is out of plastic trash. And plastic is harder to sort now than it's ever been. And no matter how we went around in circles in the interviews, they were not able to sort of figure out how to solve those fundamental problems. And then, of course, there's one other really big problem with the idea that they will recycle 100% of the plastic they make. If the oil industry recycles 100% of the plastic it makes, then there's no reason for anybody to buy their oil. And it's hard to understand how an industry will want to put itself out of business.
So what should we do in the meantime just put our milk jugs and soda bottles in the blue bin and forget the rest and try to cut down on buying plastic?
It's a difficult question, and I wish, even as an individual, that I had a really specific answer. What I can tell you is that somehow along the way, when it came to reduce, reuse, and recycle, we forgot about the first two, and we ended up on recycle, and it took all the oxygen out of the room. There's an element to reducing and reusing that can solve so much of this problem. And then the other part is simply knowing that when you buy plastic and when you're looking at in utter defeat, as I do, into your grocery cart and not knowing what to do, that at least there's an awareness that all of this plastic is not going to get recycled. And know that when you buy it, you are going to be throwing it out and it is going into the landfill. And even knowing that is a significant change and departure from where we've been for the past 30 years.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for your reporting. Really important work. So thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
NPR investigative reporter Laura Sullivan. You can check out her reporting on the plastics industry and the deception over recycling at npr.org. Coming up, Low Times for High Times magazine. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. High Times. For decades, it has been the monthly magazine for all things marijuana, the preferred periodical for pot smokers, but also growers and farmers. It was also the home of Good Journalism, part of a counterculture trinity, along with Rolling Stone and Playboy, the articles, of course. Now, in an age of legalization, you would think High Times would be flourishing, but the magazine has not. It's stumbled. It's faltered while trying to take advantage of the so-called green rush of legal weed. And a lot of the same issues the magazine has faced have plagued the broader cannabis industry. Ben Schreckinger told this story in a recent issue of Politico magazine. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So take us back to the heyday of High Times. The magazine began in 1974. So a lot of people were really into smoking weed. I guess they still are. But back then it was a sign of the counterculture. And talk about how this magazine started. What were the early days like?
The early days, it was described by one former editor as a rocket. It was the Playboy of pot, he said. This was something that came out of the anti-Vietnam War protest movement, the counterculture. It was created by a man named Tom Forsaud, whose previous claims to fame were putting a cream pie in the face of a congressional commissioner on the equivalent of C-SPAN back then on live national television when he was hauled before this panel to discuss obscenity, being indicted for an alleged plot to firebomb the Republican National Convention in 1972 in Miami. This guy was a real deal drug smuggler who used the profits from that to fund this magazine. So it was a real outlaw outfit that ended up publishing a lot of big names from that era's counterculture and a lot of important journalism at that time.
Like what? What was the important journalism?
They had an original interview with the Dalai Lama in one of their early issues. One of their big causes was doing one of the first in-depth investigations of our government's war on drugs in Latin America. This investigation helped spur a congressional investigation into the matter. So that was one of their big early coups.
So Forsaud, this larger-than-life figure, he ended up taking his own life. He was only 33. So after that, what happens? We're getting into the 80s, and I think cocaine becomes the drug of choice, or at least culturally speaking. How does that coincide with High Times?
So for a few years after Forsaud's death, especially late 70s, early 80s, the magazine really embraces cocaine. A lot of people in hindsight feel the magazine lost its way in those years. It eventually did shift back to primarily marijuana coverage later in the 80s under an editor named Steve Hager, who was much more conventionally political. And then later in the 80s under Hager, there's a lot of more direct agitation for marijuana legalization, organization of rallies, and ultimately clashing with the federal government and its war on drugs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I know it as kind of a goofy publication, but as you say, and you detail in your story, this magazine was taken seriously at very various points in its history. Now, one would think it would be in a position to really take advantage of pot going mainstream, of weed everywhere. I mean, it's legal in many places here in California, most notably. So why hasn't it been able to take advantage of this moment?
That's a great question. And it did have what some of its former staffers describe as a golden age from about 2005 to 2015. That was a decade when the marijuana legalization movement was really gaining steam. Then its chairman died, who was sort of the second leader after Forsaad, this man named Michael Kennedy, who had been Forsaad's lawyer. He succumbed to cancer in early 2016. And the publication sort of became rudderless, ended up being bought out by a private equity firm that had very different ideas from the staff about the direction of it. And that's been what's been going on with High Times the last 3 years now, as it steadily has reduced its output, reduced its staff, and generally lost its way in the view of its longtime fans.
Well, like a lot of publications, this one, though, doesn't seem to know exactly what its identity should be, because High Times is also planning to open dispensaries here in L.A. and Las Vegas. Why is it doing that if it's supposedly covering the industry? Why would it want to also open dispensaries? I mean, I know the short answer is money, but doesn't that compromise the brand?
That is certainly a complaint of members of the old guard who point out that there's a reason that Rolling Stone magazine doesn't have a record label. But you're right that the short answer is money. Media, digital media, is often not a lucrative business, often a very low margin business. Private equity firm coming into the cannabis space, it's because there's this expected green rush. There's been for a few years now an expectation that this is going to be a big business and that the people who get in early on the actual cultivation and selling of marijuana are going to make fortunes. So that's the direction that High Times has taken. It brings with it a huge amount of risk because the regulation of marijuana is so onerous. Despite legalization, where it is legalized, its legal status is still very ambiguous.
Right. So how is this new CEO, Adam Levin, how is he viewed both within the magazine and among its fans?
Well, the way he put it to me in an email is some would say I'm cutthroat. Some would say I'm a great guy with a heart of gold. It depends what that person has to gain from the situation. From the people that I spoke to, more of them would say cutthroat than heart of gold. Again, this was a stoner mag. The vibe was largely mellow. That's largely the ethos of people who have been involved in marijuana for many years. And so when you come in from a private equity firm, and you're talking about trying to do an IPO or trade publicly, you're making layoffs, it has seriously ruffled feathers. And it's been viewed as emblematic of this larger trend in cannabis, where something that was a counterculture, where the people who were involved in it were believers in a cause for many years, are now faced with the arrival of a sort of Wild West business scene all of a sudden, and there's a real culture clash there.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it definitely is not the era of Jerry Garcia anymore. That's for sure.
No, RIP.
So what happens to the magazine? Will it survive?
That's a great question. It paused publication. That's how it described it. It paused publication during coronavirus of its print edition. Levin has said that they are working on bringing the magazine back, but it seems to be going the way of a lot of these big legacy magazines of the 20th century, which is that they still exist in a form, but are really shadows of their former selves.
Ben Schreckinger from Politico, where he's written a big story on the rise and fall of High Times magazine. Ben, thank you.
thanks so much for having me.
And that'll do it for us today. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever, wherever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, thanks for listening. Have a great day. Stay safe. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.